All right. Hey, everybody. It's Got Sad for the Sad Truth. I'm here with the adult film star Mercedes Carrera. Very excited to have her on the show. We'll be talking about the science of porn. We'll be talking about her own experiences in the porn industry. Maybe we'll bring in some consumer behavior angles to the discussion. So I'm very much looking forward to it. Thank you so much for doing this, Mercedes.
Thank you so much for having me, Gad. I'm so excited to talk with you. I've been
Likewise.
so excited this week.
Now, tell me honestly, were you more nervous about speaking with me or doing one of your shoots?
Nervous. I think I was more excited to talk to you than probably one of my shoots. So
I
they all said that you're the Gadfather. I said, well, I'm actually more excited to talk to Gad than to go work. So.
Well, that's going on my CV. All right. So first, I thought what we could do is start by talking about your background in any way that you'd like to describe it, and then kind of lead into what I know that you're an engineer by training, and what led you to then consider going into porn. We can maybe start with that, and then we can see how it goes.
Okay, well, I kind of fell into porn. It wasn't I never thought I'd be a porn actress, really. I started in school. I went to school for manufacturing engineering. I worked in aerospace for about 5 years. I did systems testing for optical systems that were space-based. I mean, I did a really specialized job. And then from there, I went into telecom. The economy is very up and down in Southern California, so that was part of it. And part of my departure from aerospace had to do with the fact that my career and my training were so highly specialized that outside of three companies, it's almost useless. So when I was in aerospace, it was the early 2000s, and long story short, I decided to go to telecom, which was consumer electronics. I did that for a few years and I really hated the corporate structure. I think I'm inherently very creative, which engineers should be,
Right.
actually, but the current scientific tech environment doesn't really cultivate that. So I left and I ended up doing AV production and engineering, which I still do.
Okay.
And I ended up working with people who work in mainstream TV and mainstream film, and a lot of those people also work in porn. And so this is happening, and I really still didn't have an interest necessarily in porn. I always liked porn. I've always liked pushing the envelope. I like the things that other people are offended by. I think, inherently, because I feel like these types of genres give people a psychological outlet, and I've always found that to be important. And throughout the years, I've studied Jungian psychology. I took a certification course in hypnotherapy and hypnosis and NLP and all these different psychological tools because I was interested in how the brain works. So, I ended up doing production for a company that required I cast models that did kind of erotic nudes. I put up a modeling profile to cast them. And I had some old modeling photos. I'd modeled for a bit back when I was like a late teenager. And so anyway, I had this up and I started getting all these porn offers. And then it's a small world, so I knew people who were in the industry and I took a few different shoots and I kind of fell into it. And given my age, and my ethnicity, I'm not really in the most popular bracket in terms of porn actresses, and we can talk about that.
Sure.
So when I started, I kind of thought, well, I went to an agency. They said, well, you're a little bit older. You might work 3 or 4 times a month. And I thought, this is still really fun and it's great money. And I liked it. I liked the opportunity to be in front of the camera as opposed to behind it.
Right.
So I thought, okay, I'll take a few gigs a month. And if I don't get any, that's fine. And I really wasn't invested in it. And I signed with an agency and I started working almost every day. I mean, I just started getting
Wow.
called back, and every company I think I've shot with has shot me multiple times.
Right.
And yeah, and I became very kind of popular with the producers and the directors because I have film experience from the other side. So,
Right.
and we could talk about the performance art of pornography because it's
Sure.
not just people having sex and cameras. It's, there's more that goes into it. So it became a career inadvertently.
How long did it take from when you were first approached to you then deciding to do it? I mean, was it, did you have to really, were you conflicted in any at all, or was it a pretty easy decision once the offer started coming in?
I would say it was pretty immediate.
Okay.
There were two things that I had in my favor. The first one was having a lot of production experience. When I walked onto a porn set, I realized it's basically an indie film with a skeleton crew. So the setup of it, people have this perception of pornography like it's Boogie Nights.
Right.
And it's not. It's really production, and we're really on budgets and schedules, and so it kind of runs that way. And I was very familiar with that.
Right.
The other part is, I didn't get into the industry till I was 30, so my any sort of psychological conflict I might have had about it at 21, and we can talk about that too,
yes.
Because they use a lot of these examples of very young women who really don't have a good psychological basis for who they are, who become conflicted about their prior actions, and that becomes leverage.
Right. So, I mean, can I stop you right there?
Uh-huh,
because that's
yeah.
it's a perfect lead-in. So I've written a few articles on my Psychology Today blog about the porn industry mm-hmm. from various angles, sometimes from an evolutionary perspective, other times from a consumer perspective. And so one of the articles that I had written where I was summarizing somebody else's work, they were talking mm-hmm. about what are the main – they had studied, I think, 177 porn actresses. I can't remember the exact number, looking mm-hmm. at what were the motives that drove them into the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in your description a few minutes ago, you pretty much mentioned all of them. I think their top three, if I'm remembering correctly, were money, fun, and sex.
Mm-hmm.
Does that seem to be pretty accurate?
Probably, I think it's... Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, so probably money easily the number one reason, and then the other factors probably a lot less important.
You know, I think for myself, it was a combination of the top three. And at 30, I mean, I'm older now, but I was acutely aware of the fact that they always say youth is wasted on the young. So I have worked very restrictive jobs. I had a security clearance. I've had to do that. And I've worked around people who are 20, 30, 40 years older than myself. And I saw in a lot of them, the lamentation that they hadn't spent their youth well.
Right.
So there's kind of two paths in life. You either go down the party fun path, and then at 50, you're standing there going, wow, I haven't accumulated any wealth. I have no future. I don't know what to do. Or there's the people who do everything by the book and then stand there at 50 and go, oh, gosh, I wasted my youth being corporate. Right. So I saw that, and I kind of did things backward where at I'm aware of the fact that at my own age, I don't have a lot of time left to perform. That's the reality. It's very unusual to see a performer after 40. It happens, but it's rare.
Or if it's niche, I guess if it's niche markets, right?
Very niche. And then as a result of it being very niche, it's just not as popular, right? So to be a bigger time performer, you kind of do that between 20 and 40. I'm on the older end. And so I saw it as a wonderful opportunity because I see life as an opportunity to experience a lot of things. And so it's definitely money, but I do pretty well as an AV engineer too.
Right.
So if I wanted to work a little bit harder in a different field, I could make similar money. I could make more important. But money was everybody works for money. If if I was an heiress, I don't know that I would do anything except philanthropy all day. I don't know. But I'm not. So money, but also the fun, the experience. And I enjoy the industry I have almost a philosophical attachment to it from the standpoint of free speech, which I think is unusual in the industry. I think I'm an outlier in that respect. But most of the girls, you talk to them, and it's money, it's sex, it's free time. They live a party lifestyle. This fits in perfectly with it.
Now, there is a stereotype, which actually has also been tested scientifically, and mm-hmm. at least scientifically it has been disproven, but someone whom I know in the industry actually argued otherwise, and I'll get to that in a second. So there's something called the damaged good hypothesis, which
mm-hmm.
you may have heard of it, which for our viewers who may not know, it's basically the idea that typically, here we're talking about female actresses, that if they go into the porn industry, it must be, if you'd like, because of some downstream effect of them having been damaged in their past. There's sexual abuse, there's substance abuse, there's maybe psychological parental abuse. There is something mm-hmm. that went wrong in their past that led them to make this otherwise career choice that other women would not find very attractive. And this was actually tested scientifically, and I have an article. By the way, I'll put links to all of the articles that I mentioned at the bottom of the descriptor of the video. And actually, that was disproven. But then, mm-hmm. so Well, first, I'll ask you to comment about that. What do you think? Is that your perspective?
Well, I think there are several types of actresses in the industry. There are the girls who get in at 18, 19, 20, and a lot of them you can find the damaged goods hypothesis within it because they're girls who, and these are the same girls that are used in the Hot Girls Wanted videos and all this. And this is why some producers are actually pulling to have the minimum age raised to 21 for this reason. So there's conflict in the industry about this because at 18, 19, 20, it's hard to kind of know what you want in life. But having worked in mainstream production, to be frank, I think performers in general have the kind of psychology that leads to maybe more abundant drug use and partying and this type of thing. So I think, people want to point to porn actresses because they have a discomfort of for what we are performing. But I can talk about rock stars and models and fashion models and TV actors, and I guarantee you that you'll see just as much, if not more, dysfunction in that world than you see in pornography. And I say this having worked in both. Now, the women who get into porn or older, I'm going to say 25 and up, tend to do so deliberately, tend to have prior life experience, and tend to not fit the damaged goods hypothesis. So if you look at a lot of the women who've been very successful, they don't necessarily. The other thing is, when you talk about damaged goods hypothesis, I worked in corporate around plenty of people who grew up in dysfunction, had been abused, what have you. So, and people don't want to talk about that because, this woman works in HR at a aerospace company, therefore she's functional. But the reality is, when I hear these people's relationship stories, it's very, very similar to what I hear in the porn industry. So I think it kind of it's indicative of a lack of life experience when people make those types of claims, when the numbers really prove otherwise, as you stated.
So probably the hypothesis that you're proposing is that the damaged good hypothesis might hold true for the ones who enter the industry earlier, but then for those who enter past a certain age of maturity, then it's likely to be falsified. I think that's fair to say, right?
I
Now,
think so.
I wanted to, the guy that I had interviewed, so you are my second porn star who I'm interviewing, the first female porn star. The first one I interviewed was actually an interview that I published on my Psychology Today blog, and I'll sort of tell you the background about him, and I'll even ask you if you know him, and maybe you've even worked with him. I'm not sure. So I received an email maybe 4 or 5 years ago. I can't remember exactly when, from a gentleman who said, "Look, I've been an admirer of your scientific work. I'd like to perhaps work under your supervision as a PhD student." He already had a master's, and he wanted to go into academia. He said, "But I just want to tell you that I used to be a former pornographer, both in terms of behind the camera, but I also was an actor in many movies." And actually, he was the one who said that from his experience, the damaged good hypothesis held true. But in any case, I ended up inviting him up to visit me in Montreal. I was a bit tentative in terms of whether I should accept him or not. Not because he was a porn star, but maybe there wasn't necessarily a fit. Eventually, he decided that he didn't want to go into academia, and we never ended up working together. But anyways, his name is, I don't know if you know him, his real name is Dave Mesh, but his performer name was a very apt name, Dave Pounder. Does
Oh,
that
Dave Pounder. Yes, I know who he is.
Oh, you do know him? Okay, well, I guess it's a small enough industry that people know one another. Yeah, so anyway, so that was so you are officially my second porn contact in this context. So the next question I guess I wanted to ask you, and then I actually wanted to tell you a couple of funny stories that I've had with porn person. Actually, maybe I'll tell you about them now, and you tell me what you think. Actually, there's three quick stories. First, very quick story, and I didn't know if I should be happy or upset to have that comparison. A couple of people wrote in various forums, "Oh, this guy is the Ron Jeremy of evolutionary psychology." So it could either be because they're comparing our weights, in which case I'm not happy because I think I'm more svelte, or we're both hairy, but I'm not really that hairy. Or it could be something else, in which case I'm sort of happy about that. So anyway, so that's my first porn story. My two other porn stories. So this is going back to about maybe the 1997. So this is 17, 18 years ago. I was in my early 30s, and I'm sitting at this fitness club that I used to hang out with in, at, and I was reading a book. A guy comes up to me who I knew, and he says, "Listen, in a few minutes, you're gonna come over there. I'm sitting with a girl. I'm trying to pick her up." I told her a baloney story about you. I told her that you used to be a porn star in your earlier life trying to get through university. You'll come up to us and you'll just go with the story. To which I answered, "Come on, man, I'm not into this. I'm reading my book." He said, "Look, help a brother out. Come over. Just shut your mouth, close your book, come and play along." So, okay. I decide to play along. I come over. And then, of course, the girl was looking at me with very googly eyes. And so I played along, and I explained to her that, it was really tough for me because we didn't have enough money. So I had to be a porn star on the side. And then after we had sort of played her for maybe 20, 25 minutes, I said, "Look, I feel really guilty. I don't want to continue with this charade. This is all a setup. I'm actually not a porn star. I'm a professor." To which she looked at me and said, "Yeah, right. Like, I'm going to believe that." To which I said, "Now that's very interesting. You're more willing to buy that I used to be a porn star than that I am a professor." So I've never known what to make of that. Maybe you could psychoanalyze that for me. And then the final story, I used to, when I was working on my first book, I would often take my laptop and go sit at a local Starbucks and work for, for 8, 10, 12 hours a day. And so often students who wanted to meet me outside of office hours would come there to meet me to discuss stuff. And so often there'd be, young people always, hanging around me, asking me questions. So one day, one of the Starbucks employees came up to me and said, "Excuse me, sir, do you mind if I ask you what you do as a profession?" I said, "Oh, yes, I'm a professor." And I started getting into all the technical details. I applied biology and consumer behavior. And so his eyes are completely bored. I said, "Well, I noticed that you don't seem to be very excited by this answer." He goes, "No, frankly not." I said, "Well, why not?" He goes, "Well, I had created this fantasy in my head that you were a porn producer and you were interviewing all of these beautiful young people." I said, "Well, what would make you think that?" He goes, "Well, you always sit in the corner. You seem everybody treats you with reverence and respect. They're always young. And so what's the deal with all these people thinking I'm somehow linked to porn? Please explain to us."
That's great. Well, you know, I think well, I think they want you to be, and you're handsome and
Well,
you're
thank you.
jovial, and
There you
you're definitely better looking than Ron. I love Ron,
Oh
but
boy. By the way, this, don't worry, my wife won't see this interview. She thinks I'm interviewing a evolutionary psychologist. No,
well.
but she knows I'm interviewing you. But anyways, so let's get, since we're talking about wife and marriage, is it difficult for porn actors in general, and if you'd like to personalize it to yourself, to maintain or have a serious relationship with someone while they are, active in the porn industry as performers?
You know, I think there's it's kind of a multifaceted question because usually performers date each other for this reason. Because when you perform, you're very aware of that you're performing. It's not personal. Like, it's almost, and there are different Eastern practices on this, like practices of mindfulness and practices of being able to connect with somebody for a moment and then be at peace with putting it away. And I think that generally humanity is not good at that because there's a lot of attachment. And most people turn sex into attachment. I mean, I look at sex as though as the same way I look at food or eating. Like, I can love somebody's restaurant and eat there every day, but it doesn't mean that sometimes I don't want to go out and have a hamburger. That's how I see it. And I think that for most of human history, that's probably how humans functioned, either covertly or overtly. And you could give me more information on that. But as a performer, this is why in the industry they consider people outside the industry as civilians, because there's a different mentality. And sometimes, and again, the other part of this is you have to think you're talking about performers the same way you're talking about actors or musicians. So how many Hollywood marriages last? How many rock and roll marriages last? These are performers first and foremost. They happen to be in pornography. When their relationships fail, I think it has to do more with the performer mentality and the kind of insecurity slash narcissism that comes with being a performer, more than it has to do with porn itself. Usually the marriages that last in the industry are the relationships that work. it's one person is either a producer or not in the industry in total, and the other person's a performer. And I think it's because psychologically they kind of make up for what the other person lacks.
Right.
But it takes a very strong, secure person. So a lot of the men who date performers, when it goes well, they're men who've either performed or they're men who have exposure to the industry and they understand very well that it's work. The couple that won the two best performer spots last year, best male performer and best female performer, their names are Annika Albright and Mick Blue, and they're married.
Okay.
And they both won the top performer spots, and they're amazing, and they have an amazing relationship, and they're very close, and they do a lot of performing together as well as apart. In the industry, there's also Kiss of Sins and Johnny Sins, and they're together, they do content, and they, and you know, these are people who are truly kind of modern bohemians, so their understanding of sexuality is very different. It is hard for people to date outside of the industry, but it's not unheard of. I know female performers who were married coming into the industry, and they came in, they literally went from being a civilian to being in the industry and have very supportive husbands. And vice versa. I know a male performer whose wife encouraged him to get into the industry because he had such a high sex drive and he was so talented at sex. And she goes, "This is almost a waste for you to not use this talent."
Wow.
So, yeah, it requires almost a greater sense of love, greater sense of comfort, greater sense of creating space for somebody's needs and wants. And in that way, I think it's almost quasi-spiritual.
Right. Now I'm going to posit a hypothesis. Uh-huh. I think that from an evolutionary perspective, it would be more difficult for men, so civilian men, to accept their woman being an actress in the in the industry than the other way around. And so here, let me point to some evolutionary studies. So there's a great study that was done in the early 90s that has been replicated a million times since by David Buss, who's a famous evolutionary psychologist, and some of his colleagues, where they brought people into the lab and they set them up with these physiological measures to measure their stress levels. And then they had them, they read to them one of two anecdotes. An anecdote that cues emotional infidelity in your partner. So if I were to say, you know, Mercedes, your partner is currently having lunch every day with his female coworker. They really understand each other. She laughs at his jokes. They're growing emotional, but no sex. So that's one version. That's emotional infidelity. And the other version, you cue sexual infidelity. So right now you're at work, your partner is having sex with a gorgeous girl or a gorgeous guy, whatever. Now, of course, what you end up finding using the physiological, and the reason why they use physiological measures is precisely because they don't want people to potentially lie about their responses, right? So your physiology doesn't lie. And so what you end up getting is that men and women respond to the same level, but to different triggers. So men respond the most to sexual infidelity, and then women to emotional. And then the evolution argument, of course, is very simple. And it's not that men don't care about emotional infidelity and that women don't care about sexual, but in terms of actual amount, the argument is that, of course, men have a problem of paternity uncertainty. Therefore, they would have evolved the emotional and behavioral and cognitive systems to really resent having their women shared with other men. Right. And then women, of course, are much more concerned about their men leaving them. And of course, it's a much bigger precursor of a man leaving if he forms a bond with another woman. That's why if he cheats on a woman, he's willing to say, hey, it meant nothing. It was at a conference. I was just having fun. It was a one-time thing and so on. And so from that perspective, I would suspect that for most civilian men to watch their partner having sex with another woman is probably going to be very difficult to do. And I don't think necessarily it's a question of insecurity. I think it really takes a truly unique specimen to not be jarred by that reality, right?
Right. And I think, you know, you hit a really good point there, which is, you know, women are worried about resource loss and men are worried about paternity. In the industry, again, the people who work together, they're performers together. So, I mean, it's almost the modern day equivalent of being a carny, really, because you're that far outside on the fringe of society and how you see things. And I think and there are examples in the industry, especially of male performers even getting married to a female performer and asking her to stop performing. And usually that will lead to a divorce several years later, because when you tell a performer to stop performing, usually that doesn't go well, just psychologically on that. And sometimes it does. Sometimes some of the women are like, yeah, you know what? I'm happy to get out of this. I want to stay home and have kids. And, right. and then those ones work. And then some of them are like, the women think it's a good idea. They get 2 or 3 years in and go, oh, I'm so bored. Right. I'm used to the limelight and the attention right. and all of that. And so now that that's been taken away, and it's been taken away because of this person,
right.
then the resentment starts to brew.
Right.
So, you know, and this is where... Now, conversely, though, I know anecdotally relationships where the husbands were very supportive because the finances, and usually the guys were supportive of it. If you were to take it from that evolutionary biology kind of standpoint, they're usually super alphas
right.
who are like, well, absolutely. It's almost like they're okay with it. Like, get, like my girl's going to go out and make money for our little tribe.
Right.
And... but she's coming home
right.
at the end of the day.
Right.
And there's that kind of thing too. And it, you know, and then humans aren't like, there's so much that, you know, it's so complex and it's
right.
so unique, but generally the trend is absolutely what you're saying.
Now, do you think that, so there's this psychometric scale called mm-hmm. the SOI, Social Sexual Orientation Inventory, which is a very quick measure that you could take. I think mm-hmm. the original one is 5 items and the more recent one is 9 items. And so SOI basically measures a person's penchant for unencumbered sex, right? You know, I'm happy to have a one night stand. I often desire other people and so on. And so so basically, as you might expect, there is a sex difference on SOI. Men score mm-hmm. higher on that scale than women. But then within
yeah.
each sex, there are huge differences, right? So there are some
yeah.
men that's right. Now, do you think a priori that in the porn industry, both men and women who perform in the industry are likely to score higher on SOI than their respective counterparts in the civilian world, or not necessarily? You cannot make the argument that a performer's sexuality is somehow different innately just because she's in the industry. What's your take on that?
That's actually really interesting, because what a lot of performers find is they score very high on that scale until they're in the industry. And then when sex becomes work and it has a different association,
right.
then a lot of the performers go from having lots of sex with lots of people indiscriminately as civilians to suddenly being in the industry. And then when your body is suddenly how you make money, your health and safety and
right.
Discrimination suddenly matter more.
Wow.
So then what happens is then everybody's, it's, I've noticed this, it's kind of like in phases. They come in, they're indiscriminate, then it's, you know, I'm going to have sex with everybody in the industry. And then after a year or two, that starts to lose its luster, because it's a tiny industry. There's probably 80 active male performers at any time and maybe 500 active females. It's small.
Right.
And so then what happens is the performers go, oh, this becomes work, especially the men, because just from a biological standpoint, how many times can you ejaculate
right.
each day? You know, it takes, again, guys who are super outliers can do it, but even within the industry, that's abnormal.
The refractory period is a BITCH.
Exactly. And so then what happens is a lot of times the performers get into relationships with each other, and then that becomes their home base, and then they go do their work.
Right.
But then it becomes really, it's funny, like a lot of the guys will say when they're offset, they're like, I'm not giving the show. I'm not doing the 35-minute sexual encounter, and I'm not doing this unless you pay my rate. Like a lot of the guys say, oh, when I date girls, and a lot of the guys start to date girls out of the industry because they're so maxed out on the porn that in their spare time they date civilian girls that they're like 5 minutes, 10 minutes. That's all
right.
you're going to get out of me. So it's interesting when it becomes normalized. We
right.
become almost so normal, and a lot of the people in the porn industry are so normal when you're talking to them daily, because once everything's destigmatized, there's just not a whole lot left. We can talk openly about just about anything, and so it doesn't matter as much.
And how about in terms of their abilities? I mean, are people being chosen predominantly because of their physical looks, right? I mean, the women are very beautiful. The guys are obviously typically well endowed. They're in shape. Or is it a lot more in terms of their actual, you know, mechanics? They're better lovers. They're better sex partners. Is it both? Is it one more than the other? What's the story?
Well, in porn, it's less about being good sex, and it's more about being good at performing sex. And so, with the men are typically chosen because their penises can work on command, and they can ejaculate on command, and they can last enough time. And porn sex, you're filming it for the benefit of the viewer. You're not film like there's different types. I mean, there's so many different types of sex, but generally, when you that's why there's only maybe 80 active male performers at a time and 20 really good ones, because it takes a really special man to be able to perform well, ejaculate on command. The girls aren't always easy to work with, neither are the guys, but the guys generally are working every day, whereas the women tend to work maybe a few times a week. So the men have to be on their A game, and that's generally why they're chosen. They're chosen for penis size. Like, you can have a guy who's, and the reason for that, people say, well, why do they use such huge penises in porn? Well, usually people are fucking and they're kind of fucking closed like this, but you have to open it up. So now you need this guy to be able to get in there and be able to see it. It's just, that's all it is. It's mechanics. And so with the men, it's how well are they liked by the girls? Do they smell good? Can they perform well? Because if you fail a scene, and by failing a scene, it's either you can't ejaculate on time or you ejaculate too soon or can't stay hard or what have you. And some of these experiences were in hot studios because we have to turn the air off for filming, and we're in weird locations and we're cold or, whatever it is. It takes somebody who's very robust as a male to do that. And so the male performers are kind of the unsung heroes of the industry. And they're the ones who are truly objectified, which is also interesting because they're literally just a penis on a body for the most part.
And I think it's the only industry or one of the only industries where the women make a lot more money. So the gender gap in pay is exactly reversed and quite substantially. Is that correct?
Quite substantially. I mean, really, it's arguable that there's a gender. Like, when I worked in tech, I was paid per pay grade experience and education, and I was paid the same as my male colleagues, and there are laws in place for that. In pornography, women make on average 2 to 3 times per shoot. So you're looking at 200-300%. It's a lot. And, so we could say men are making 30-50% of their female colleagues in the industry. There's no outcry on that.
But how come the laws that are in place in all other contexts somehow are not operative in that context? I mean, why hasn't that gap been lessened?
The state doesn't really like pornography. Their only interest in us is shutting us down. So they haven't really ventured into that field. We're also private contractors. We're not employees, so that probably is the legal protection aspect of it. With the women, see, the thing with the women is we might be paid more, but we might work less. A lot of the women work. Like, I work quite a lot for a woman in the field. I work consistently and
So how,
reliably
is it per day or is it per scene? How do you quantify it?
Per scene,
Per scene, okay.
we're paid per scene. That's
Okay.
generally how it works. Sometimes, because of the nature of it, it's basically like working on an independent film. The men will work very, very consistently, so they'll take less pay. The other reason for it is because there are a lot of men out there who would love to have the job, and as a man, it's very hard to get into the industry because a director has to trust that you're not going to fail the scene. Because if you fail the scene, now everybody is screwed for the day financially. So they want guys who are ringers. And it's tough to get in to the industry and usually a lot of the guys who get in, it's because they're a husband or a boyfriend of a female performer. And so she'll test him out, like he'll be tested and proven, and then the directors go, okay, I feel comfortable hiring him because there's a fail-safe. If the guy fails the scene, I know his gal's gonna kick me back a free scene to help make up for it or whatever. Like, so there's that kind of bargaining that happens. So the men have to usually be brought in by the women.
Now
They
I'm sorry. Now the so the what you're basically saying is that it's a lot more difficult to find good performers who are male, if only because of the physiological realities. Now, has the little blue pill sort of created equality amongst many of the men? I mean, what I mean by that is that maybe 25 years ago, it really took a unique specimen to be able to do all the things that you said. Whereas, of course, today you also need a guy who could perform, but maybe it creates a bit less pressure in terms of barriers to entry. If I could pop that Viagra, no?
Well, it does. It does in terms of keeping the dick hard, but it doesn't help you ejaculate on command. So this is where it's still they can't, and a lot of the men do, especially if we have super long shoots, they'll use an aide to help them
Okay.
stay hard. The reason some of the best top performers are considered to be top is that they don't have to, and
Okay.
everybody knows it, that they're not the ones who have to use that stuff.
Right.
So, and these are guys who, if you look at them physiologically, they're higher
Right.
testosterone, like their bodies indicate it, big jaws and
Yeah.
tall and all this kind of stuff. So you see markers in them.
Yes.
What Viagra and CaverJect have done, and this has been a really big kind of controversy in the industry, is it's brought performers over from the gay side of the industry. So the gay porn industry and the straight porn industry run independently of each
Right.
other. The reason for that, it has nothing to do with homophobia. The gay porn industry doesn't use our testing protocols. We test every 2 weeks for HIV, syphilis, hepatitis, gonorrhea, chlamydia, syphilis, and I think something else that I can't remember offhand. Every two weeks, every 14 days, we have to have a clean test to work.
Right.
Anything comes up, no go, can't work.
Right.
The treatable bacterial ones, you have to treat it, get retested, come up clear, and work. You come up with HIV, you're done. No, you will never work again. On the gay side of the industry, they don't have testing protocols, they use condoms. And the reason for that was in the 80s and 90s, a lot of their top performers, my understanding is, had HIV or have HIV. So they didn't want to adopt those testing protocols because it would kick a lot of their stars out.
Right.
So they chose to work independent. Now, with CaverJect and with Viagra, some of the better. Now, here's the other part. A lot of the men who are really good performers in the straight world aren't necessarily attractive conventionally.
Ron
There are
Jer
some.
Ron Jeremy.
Right, exactly. It's the men who are higher testosterone, but it
Right.
doesn't mean that they are necessarily hot.
Right.
A lot of the cutie pie good-looking guys are on the gay side or on the bisexual side, so they started working in our industry. And they come up with a clean test at this point. It's not as big of a deal because our microRNA test picks up HIV before you can transmit it, so it's less of an issue. But that's why these things are controversial, because if you have someone who's a really good-looking guy on the gay side who decides, hey, you know what, I'm going to go work on the straight side to pick up extra cash, and he's using CaverJect, which is an injection to make the penis hard, and it lasts about 2 hours.
Right.
We are potentially being exposed to risk because they don't
Right.
test the same way. So inside the industry, there's a lot of constant conversation about
Right.
health, and that's part of the reason it's hard to find men, because anybody who's ever worked on the gay side is pretty much eliminated
Right, gotcha.
from the straight side.
But you know, the gay straight jumping point is a really good one because it's an argument that I have used when discussing with you. So, for example, of course, there's a stigma to porn, right? So on the so, and we'll talk, I guess, if you want about the feminist stuff. So of course, there's a very staunch group of feminists who argue that, I mean, pornography basically exists simply as a tool of the patriarchy, right? To subjugate and exploit women and so on. And of course, there are many counter arguments to that, but one is to actually use the dichotomy of gay and straight, and that is that if you look at many of the behaviors in gay porn that are happening between men, there will be exactly the same ones that are happening in the heterosexual world, which basically points to the fact that it is catering to male sexuality rather than if it were about subjugation of women, then you shouldn't be able to see the same, say, money shot in the context of gay porn. But you see it because the only thing that changes is the target of my desire changes from female to male, but you are catering to male evolved sexuality. And usually that gets them to shut up because that's a very powerful way to demonstrate that it's simply about good marketing, right? I mean, porn marketers, if we can talk about marketing, since ultimately I'm a professor of consumer psychology, I mean, right? I mean, they're not in the business of subjugating anyone. They're in the business of making money. And therefore, if we want to understand the things that appeal to our innate human nature, in this case, if we're talking about men, then we're going to create products that are successful when catering to men. In the same way that if we look at romance novels, the plot lines in romance novels, the archetype of the male hero is going to be the exact same male archetype, whether you're targeting women in Nigeria or in France or in Cuba. He's going to be tall, he's going to be dominant, he's going to be a count, he's going to be a neurosurgeon, he's going to wrestle alligators on his six pack. I always use this archetype because it's really that's exactly what it is, right? It's this exaggerated stereotype. And so they, so maybe we could talk about this. I mean, so you've got the feminists who argue that it's all about, you know, subjugation and exploitation and so on. And then, of course, you've got others, other feminists who are of the exact opposite opinion, right? It's liberating, it's empowering, it's demonstrating female agency. And now, of course, I think I know where you fall, but you want to maybe comment a bit about that issue?
Sure. Well, I think that bringing up, the issue of archetype is a perfect way for us to talk about this, because if you look at it, and the feminist, the victimhood feminist, that's what I like to call them, the victim feminist, they see everything as subjugation of women. If you look at pornography and you look at what's popular, there's all kinds. There's degradation pornography where the women are tied up and choked and slapped and all that. Now, what's interesting about that is the women who perform it love it. And we can get into that because actually it's been proven feminists tend to have more rape fantasies than other women. But on the other end, you have the women who say, oh, it's liberating, it's empowering, and all of this. I fall somewhere in the middle because if you look at most of the archetypes that the female porn actresses embody in the pornography itself, you're looking at the femme fatale, you're looking at the vixen, you're looking at the maiden. So men want to either be enticed or they want to save, or both. And that's generally how male sexuality is portrayed in this. And the pornography that sells tends to stay with that within that framework. So for example, whether the girl is portrayed to be a stepdaughter or a stepmother, either way, she's the sexual aggressor. And what it allows for is, I think, psychologically, men are then allowed to be sexual because this woman's coming on to you. So you know, is in real life, usually men have to be the pursuers of the sexuality. And so there's a constant psychological load on that. Am I going to be
rejected?
dismissed or rejected? You know, rejection's huge. So when they get into the world of pornography, they're never rejected because here's this woman, whether she's 18 or whether she's 45, she wants you and she wants you now. And so it allows for men to go, oh, I'm wanted for this is really what men want. Why do men see prostitutes? Because once that exchange of money happens, they know they're not going to be rejected, right? So as a female porn actress, I sit in this in objectivity and neutrality, and I say, okay, well, this is we are creating a product for that man who may not himself be able to embody that alpha and get all the chicks, but for that 10 minutes he gets to feel that way, and that's for him psychologically necessary. It's just like the woman who is victim-y or marmy or what have you, she gets to read that romance novel and imagine she's a beautiful princess being swept away by Mr. Neurosurgeon that wrestles alligators. You know, it's the same thing. It's allowing people to be what they cannot be in real life. I think pornography is empowering as a woman if you come into it empowered and psychologically aware of who you are. I think it can be degrading as a woman if you come in and you're not, because it's all about how you hold your space as a performer. I don't do fetish work. I don't do degradation scenes. I don't really have a problem with women who do it. I know women who do it who feel very empowered afterward. I personally don't want to be tied up and spit on. So I don't do scenes like that. I do
This is the
scenes
first
that.
time that I've had a conversation on air where somebody has uttered the words that you just did. Tied up and spat on.
It's spat on. And well, and you know, it's funny. I was shooting the other day, and one of the producers, it was a very kind of benign, I do a lot of stepmothery type of scenes given my age, but he's creating a whole new series that has this subjugation, this kind of degradation, but these girls love it. They come in, the performers come in, and they're so excited to do this because they want the psychological liberation of just completely letting go and trusting somebody to bring them through kind of that valley of darkness and death psychologically by reenacting maybe abuse. Maybe they have the damaged goods hypothesis in real life, but by reenacting the abuse, but coming out safe on the other side, it allows them a psychological release. And I think it's we know this in the porn industry, and we create things that mostly sell. And guess what? That genre, it's not a big seller. Most men actually don't want to see women degraded. It's a really, really small niche market.
So let's talk about exactly what is most commonly depicted in porn movies. And this is something that I've written about. And I think I might have even sent you a few links to maybe one of the YouTube clips I had done. So let me, you may or may not know this, and some of my viewers may or may not know it, so I'll kind of tell the whole story. So if you look at mating systems throughout cultures, typically what you have is roughly 85% of cultures allow for polygyny, meaning one man with multiple women throughout history. And then you've got some, of course, monogamous mating systems. And very, very rarely, unbelievably rarely, you have what's called polyandry, one woman being shared by multiple men. So the classic example is what's called Tibetan polyandry. And it's called fratricide. It's fraternal polyandry, meaning that the men who are sharing the women are actually brothers. Right?
Oh, interesting.
And again, from an evolutionary perspective, it makes sense in that if you're going to share a woman that where you don't know that it's going to be your child or not, then at least if it's not going to be your child, it's going to, through inclusive fitness, have some of your genes. And so, so the genetic calculus, if you'd like, is not completely lost. And so typically, if you think about male fantasy, you think about the harem building, right? The I'm the Sultan and I've got seven gorgeous girls from different countries that can service me. But it turns out, so there was a study that was done back in 2002 by, and again, this is a interesting last name, Nicholas Pound, an evolutionary psychologist, where he actually did a content analysis of depictions in porn movies. Are they more likely to be polygynous, so one man with multiple women, or polyandrous, multiple men with one woman? And he found that there were many more polyandrous depictions. And then he argued that it was due to sperm competition, that sperm competition is an excitatory visual cue. And so then a few years later, some brilliant and very courageous scientists, courageous only because I could only imagine trying to get funding to do this research, they actually had two images. They gave men one of two images to go home and masturbate to. Either one that had a bunch of women, I think, having sex together, or one where there was the polyandrous depiction. And then they brought back the sperm and they studied the certain markers of certain metrics of the sperm, one of which was that the motility of sperm, how vigorous it moves, of the sperm coming from polyandrous depictions were more motile. And that supported the idea of sperm competition. And if you look at animal husbandry, a farmer will typically take his stud, and if he wants to get him turned on, he will show another male having sex with a female, and that will literally get the rise out of him. And so I often use this. I've discussed it in my books and in some of my articles, because it's such a brilliant, very serious scientific way to study something tied to pornography. So from your experience, so as a practitioner within the industry, what's your take on this? Is it true that there's a lot more polyandrous depictions, and does it seem to fit with my sperm competition story that I'm telling here?
It's interesting, because there's generally, my experience anecdotally is there's usually threesomes either way. So it's either two women on a man, and usually, and this is very interesting, and I think a lot of this goes back to these kind of Oedipal complexes and Electra complexes, where you have an older woman who's guiding the two young people to have sex. There's this teaching component, and there's this kind of maternal, you know, archetype. Or you have a woman being gangbanged, like a tribe of men are now competing to see who will impregnate this woman, right? That's the underlying psychology of it. You know, a lot of the popularity right now is in this the MILF stepmother thing, and I think a lot of that is, you know, the unresolved Oedipal complex that comes out, and that's very, very triggering for a lot of men. The other part, the other side, and I do a lot of lesbian pornography, and a lot of that is either older, younger, initiating a younger woman into lesbianism, but the biggest market, the watching market on that, tends to be men. And again, usually the men who are watching that, it's triggering their Oedipal complex, but they don't want to watch any men in it. They want to watch two women. Right. But there's a lot of mommy talk. There's a lot of that kind of thing. And the men who tend to want to watch lesbian pornography are men who are not inherently sexually competitive. So they like the idea of they're interested in seeing, and this is interesting. A lot of the female performers, there's a pathway that a lot of them take. They start doing solos, and then they usually start stripping, and then they do solos, then they do girl-girl only, then they transition to boy-girl, and then from there, you know, the list grows.
Right.
But what's fascinating is the girls who go in and do girl-girl only, and I'm very solidly bisexual. Like, on the Kinsey scale, I'm, like, right there in the middle.
And you mean in your performance career or in your personal life as well?
Personally. And then, so my performance life actually reflects, it's funny how performance ends up mirroring exactly, because usually I draw boundaries around my performance that I'm comfortable with.
Right.
So it's not a shock. And also the things I like doing, I get booked for, so it's also not a shock that I do them. But a lot of the women who do girl, girl only, with a plan to transition to doing boy, girl, a lot of the male fans are just devastated when they see this woman. That a lot of them have that kind of Madonna whore complex going on. Right. And the men who have that active in their psyches tend to love the girl because the girls are unsullied.
Right.
By it's kind of the virgin archetype.
Right.
And then when they see them finally perform with a penis, they go, no, I can't see it. I don't want to watch it.
Right.
And they'll get angry letters from fans. I knew you weren't really a lesbian. I just knew it, you know?
Wow.
So, yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Let's switch now, transition to, I think, because we have to, whenever we talk about porn, sort of the moral element, right? So, of course, you may or may not know this. Are you familiar with the tabula rasa view of the human mind, or the empty slate? So this is the idea from many social scientists.
Oh, yeah, I have heard of this. Okay, right. Go ahead.
So basically the idea is that we're born with empty minds, and it's only through socialization that we learn to be who we are. Now, of course, as somebody who's an evolutionary psychologist, I think that's a bunch of baloney. Of course, socialization matters. Of course, learning matters. Of course, the environment matters. Nobody contests that. But of course, we also come with some biological blueprints that are innate and part of our biological heritage. Now, the reason why I mentioned that is because many of the people who are proponents of the empty slate view of the human mind will oftentimes propose intervention strategies to kind of unsoil humans. So, for example, if there is a lot of violence against cops from young males, well, clearly it must be because of video games. And therefore, if we eradicate video games, then all men will just kind of hold hands and sing songs together. you know, if there is a lot of infidelity in marriages and there's a rise in divorces, well, of course, it has to be because of the porn industry. Get rid of the porn industry and everybody will live in monogamous unions forevermore. Because there's a feel-good sense to having an intervention strategy that if only you could identify the villain and eradicate it, then we could move on. And I think that oftentimes when I hear these conversations about porn, people, even though they don't verbalize it in the way that I just did, that's exactly what they're succumbing to, right? There is something just inherently immoral, sinister, evil about porn that results in all sorts of downstream ill effects. And if we get rid of it, then everything will be resolved. What's your view on that? How do you counter that perspective? Just tell me what you think.
Well, I see, and I find this to be a fascinating theory, because if you look at human development, and even in Eastern spiritual schools of thought, if you look at the tantric system, you look at the chakra system, and I don't take these to be tangible, but rather metaphoric.
Right.
The base level of the human beingness is the lizard brain. It's the eating and the pooping and all these basic physiological functions. And right above that is sexuality. And then you get into ideas of ego and power, and you get into ideas of love and trust and tribe, and you get into ideas of self-expression, and then you get into ideas of spirituality, and then, then you get into the greater collective unconscious, right?
Right.
So they are mistaking something like spirituality, which exists in a space where all these other needs are met, as being the same thing as sexuality. Sexuality is one of the most primal base urge drives. It's like eating. We are programmed for procreation. And sexuality itself, the demonstration of it, has happened for eons for a reason, because it's just like food and drink and tribe and needing power and needing land and needing water and all of these things. And the more detached they are from it, the more it becomes a disowned piece of their psyche, the stranger it gets. If you look at cultures that really disown basic human needs, especially places like in Germany and Japan, that's where you see some of the most bizarre fetishes, because everything becomes fetishized when it's disallowed. And when you have societies that are more inclusive of sexuality, allow people a psychosocial sexual output or outlet and an opportunity to kind of discuss and deal with these things, you don't see the fetishes. So, and, you know, we see this in Western culture, because children are idolized and idealized, and then when they hit adolescence, we go, we don't know how to deal with their sexuality, so we're just going to shut that down and pretend it doesn't exist. Well, guess what happens? Then you have 30-year-old men who are really into mommy MILF porn because because they've never resolved that. And it's the same thing with the women. It's the daddy complex. You see this because we don't know how to deal with sexuality through maturity. In our culture. And I think people who are proponents of the blank slate kind of, I mean, they've done, outside of sexuality, they've done experiments where it was the same thing. And you probably know the source of this, but I remember reading the proponents of this blank slate type of psychological ideal. They said, well, children are born so pure and wonderful and precious that if they just don't have teachers, if they have no influence from the outside world, they'll create a wonderful society for sharing and hope. And then what really happened was, I think they had to cut the experiment after several months because it became Lord of the Flies. They were brutal, and they were, you know, they were actually, it was proven that actually they need to be socialized. Right. And so,
socialization, incidentally, I mean, one of the things that people don't understand, they usually pit socialization against biology, whereas in reality, nurture happens in its forms because of nature, right? So socialization is not something that exists outside of our biology. It typically exists to support biological imperatives. So already when somebody starts talking about, is it socialization or is it biology, oftentimes it's the absolutely perfectly wrong question to be posing. I mean, everything ultimately goes down to biology. And that's one of the things that I have faced in my scientific work, in trying to introduce evolutionary psychology to the social sciences in general, but in consumer behavior in particular. I have faced a lot of detractors, much less so today than, say, 15 years ago. But it's because they don't like the idea that humans are driven by biological imperatives. And this is called the human reticence effect. So, so it's okay for biology to be relevant for every other species that exists, right? So if you use some evolutionary principle to explain the behavior of the mating behavior of the salamander or the hyena, oh, great work. But if you use that same evolutionary principle to explain something about human behavior, then you're a sexist, you're a Nazi, and so on. And it's ridiculous, right? I mean, it's not as though our sexuality exists somehow outside of our biology. And so that, so in a sense, I mean, one of the reasons why I like to write about things that are very much tied to our basic Darwinian drives, like food, like sex, it's because it's not difficult to make the link to Darwinian mechanisms, right? I mean, it's all about natural selection and sexual selection. I mean, those are the evolutionary processes that drive much of the evolution of any species. So when puritanical folks are somehow exhibit disdain towards sexuality, it's quite silly.
Well, it is, and what's fascinating about it is this kind of Puritanism that's coming actually from people who are so, trying so hard not to be racist or sexist or or misogynistic, what have you, that they completely negate our role as human animals in the world. Sexuality, if you, I mean, you go back to Greece and to Rome and to Tibet and to Babylonian culture and on, we could go to the cradle of civilization and find examples of sexuality being fetishized and being drawn and being created, because it's a natural drive. It's just like the Egyptians had pictures of food in their tombs. I mean, this is normal, and the more we pretend it's not, the more we actually create an unsafe environment for people to discuss these things.
Well, have you ever seen some of the findings on which countries are most likely to access on the internet, you know, pornography? And oftentimes it's the most repressive countries, right? Precisely for the reasons that you said, right? If you don't offer some channel for people to express their sexuality, I mean, they're going, that channel has to be met. And so I'm going to find a way to have it met. And so that's, and even things like the relationship between violence against women So, for example, in a there's less violence against women historically in a place like Sweden that scores very highly on gender egalitarianism than in places where the gender roles are much more delineated, let's say in Pakistan. And not surprisingly, you have a lot more people that are surfing for internet porn from Pakistan. As we know, Bin Laden was apparently found with a huge stash of porn. Hopefully not yours. I don't know if you're in the business then. Go ahead, go
Makes
ahead.
sense. No, it makes perfect sense because, again, we're disallowing this. And this is why Dworkin and the Mies Commission in the 70s
Yes.
and 80s, they were all incorrect because they claimed that with the proliferation of pornography, women would be raped on every corner.
Yeah.
And we found the opposite to be true.
Exactly.
Sexual violence against women has dropped drastically
Well, I
in the
think,
last
and the
years.
reality is that, look, if you're libertarian, you can't start. I mean, either you believe that we live in a, I mean, consenting adults. We're not talking about children. We're not
Of
talking about
course.
forcing anybody. So if you believe that people have the right to pursue any activity, commercial activity, personal activity, in any way that they want, then who are you to decide which types of songs I could remember the stuff with Tipper Gore when she was trying to get rid of all the song lyrics and so on. Well, the reality is people want to sometimes hear raunchy song lyrics. They don't want to hear Barney singing from right? So again, it's, I think it comes from, I mean, a good place, right? You're trying to affect positive changes, but you're going about it the wrong way because you don't have a proper understanding of human nature, right? It's the same story, for example, with the rape issue. So I have some colleagues, one of whom I know very well, who had written a book in the early two, I think it was in 2000, where they looked at an evolutionary perspective on rape. And I mean, I think they were getting death threats because the general response to it was, oh, you're offering an evolutionary explanation for rape. That means you're justifying it, right? Which, of course, that's not what you're doing,
Oh,
right?
of
If you
course.
want to stop rape, then you better understand properly, causally, the reasons why men rape, right? So, for example, to argue that it has nothing to do with sex and
That's
only to do with
absurd.
power, I mean, it's absurd, right? I mean, the
Ridiculous.
rapists will tell you if you interview them. So again, there is there's this conflict between my pet ideology, which I must ascribe to no matter what, and if there's any science that doesn't support it, then it has to be squashed, and that's dangerous.
Well, especially when it comes to rape, because if you look at, and this is what I find to be so fascinating about anti-porn feminists, if a man is horny and he has access on his computer to pornography and he jerks off and he ejaculates, now his testosterone level drops.
Right.
His propensity for violence drops, his
Right.
propensity for rape drops, across the board. So that's what we see. And it actually makes perfect sense from a commonsensical standpoint. I'm not an evolutionary psychologist or biologist, and it makes perfect sense. But they, I've heard this often. Oh, rape is about power and control. No, war is about power and control. Rape is about sex. Because the absence of, what is rape without sex? It's basically war. So, it's just pure violence. If I if a man wants to steal your purse, and he steals your purse, but he knocks you down and he rapes you too, well, then he wanted the sex and he wanted the purse. That's what it tells you. There's otherwise he'd just take the purse. I mean, this is a very, very simple deduction, and I find it to be really kind of a problem that we even have to have these conversations. I thought we would move past this with logic,
There's
but.
a guy, Todd Shackelford, a good friend of mine who's a evolutionist, a very, very reputable evolution psychologist in Michigan, I think at Oakland University. And I think it was in one of his papers where he cited the, I think it was the percent that, so the rate of conception that arises subsequent to a rape versus, through regular, consensual sex. And I think it was substantially higher. And so, and again, and the argument here being is that strategically speaking, when rapists are looking, they do look for nuba, fertile women. Now, that doesn't mean, now, usually what the detractors will say, then how do you explain the raping of a prepubescent child? Or how do you explain the raping of a postmenopausal woman? Now, of course, these things happen, but on average, if you look at the epidemiology of rape, it is very much nuba, fertile women who are going to be targeted. And so there are all sorts of evolutionary arguments that can help explain this phenomenon, and in
Right.
no way are you arguing that you are condoning or
Yeah.
justifying it. If anything, you're trying to do the opposite. You're trying to find the
Right.
best possible theories to help us curb this devastating tragedy.
Right, exactly. And this is the fault of this. It's the same thing with saying let's shut down porn or let's shut down anything
Right.
because we don't like the implications of what it means
Yeah.
about us as humans.
Yeah.
We're uncomfortable with being human animals, so let's pretend that doesn't exist. Let's live in the sphere of kind of the pseudo spirituality that we've set
Right.
up, that we're somehow better than all the other animals in the kingdom, you
Exactly.
know.
Let me
Yeah.
ask you this. We're almost at the end of our chat, but I don't know if this is a fair question, and you tell me if you want to answer it or not. Let's
Sure.
suppose you had a daughter or son who came to you and said, "Hey, mom, I think I'd like to take a shot at the porn industry." What would your response be? And would it be different as a function of whether it were your son or daughter asking that question?
Oh, you know, it's funny because I hadn't really thought about the gender part. As long as they're adults who are
Yeah.
making and would be capable of making a better, more informed decision, actually, than most people, given my experience in it, I absolutely would support it because actually the porn industry is quite safe. So I would be more concerned if my son decided to be an Alaskan crab fisherman or my daughter decided to go do aid work in an Ebola-stricken area. Like
Right.
I would actually be more supportive of
From a
pornography.
safety perspective.
From a
But
safety
what about
perspective.
it? Would any of your sort of free libertarian outlook somehow be shut if you try to extend it to your children, or absolutely not? You find that
No.
you would be equally free in your outlook.
I would be absolutely equally free. I think, you know, if you're a parent, you're concerned most with your child's safety. I think
Right.
that that's the most practical thing, and I think that's what most parents don't want their children to do things because they're worried about their safety first
Right.
and foremost. From a libertarian standpoint, I mean, the porn industry is a wonderful industry for women. If you get in at the right time in the right place, you can really set yourself up for life. And I know women who've done that, who are very
Right.
smart, who came in and in 5 years made far more than I would ever make as an engineer in my entire lifetime, and now
Right.
they can do all kinds of wonderful things with their life because money is freedom, and that's true. I would be more reticent if I had a son for him to go into it because I know that the hours are longer, it's harder on the men. It's a more challenging industry in a lot of ways for the men. It's harder for them to maintain relationships on the outside and that kind of thing. But you know, people always talk about children and think of the children, but I think a lot of people don't realize that when you have children, you're raising adults. You're not
Right.
raising children. So if you allow for and you create within your children a sense of critical thinking and logic and self-sufficiency, then you
Right.
should be able to support them in any legal
Right.
industry.
Right. I mean, I guess I asked the question because I see in many of the psychological mechanisms that might not have been operative in me before I had children suddenly become important after I've had children. And I can't necessarily have predicted some of these. So I give you one quick example. Next week I'm going to Mexico to give a talk at a venue. And flying was historically something that never really scared me. And I mean, I could almost probably synchronize it with when I had my first child, that I suddenly became very fearful of flying because what if the plane crashes and then I'll never and so that fear, which had been completely inactive or almost inactive prior to having children, suddenly became actually quite triggered, that oftentimes I now dread flying, even though rationally speaking, I know that probabilistically it's completely useless to worry about such a negligible probability, but I'm very concerned about it. What if I'll never see them get married? What if I die tomorrow? What so in that, I guess it was in that spirit that I was trying to see whether you're able to put yourself in the context of being a parent and whether some of your thoughts would change, but I guess you're saying they wouldn't.
Well, I think, and I know a lot of women in the industry who have children, and most of them actually mirror what I'm saying. Because when you're in the industry, we all actually like the industry, which is why we stay in it.
Right.
It's really a very wonderful job for a woman, to be frank. If you can cut it. I mean, not everybody's cut out for it. You have to
Right.
have all of the skill sets, but if you're successful, it's really kind of nice. But most of the women who have children in the industry say, look, I hope to make enough money that my child never even has to work.
Right.
But if they have to, I'd prefer them doing this than being chained to an office all day or being an aid worker in a dangerous area
right.
or flying on airplanes all day where they right. might get crashed or being in the military or what have you.
Right. So,
because I think that most people who have children, the safety component,
right.
is my child going to be here with me tomorrow?
Right.
would be the top and important is one of the lowest on the list of is my child going to be okay?
Right.
And also parents want their children to have jobs that pay them well and allow them for socioeconomic freedom.
So maybe the best way to end our chat that could go on for five more hours. So what's next for Mercedes? I mean, once I'm sure mm-hmm. you'll have many more years, you're still very young, but one day you'll want to hang up the boots, so to speak. What do you see your career trajectory going next after the porn industry?
Well, I have a lot of fingers on the hand of things that I do. Porn is one of them.
Okay.
I'm still very active in production and behind the scenes stuff, and I probably have about 3 or 4 more years left as a performer, maybe more. You know, people in the industry say, "Oh, you'll be around for 10 years," and that's possible. Nina Hartley's still around, but
is she
the one who
was in Boogie Nights?
I don't know if she was in Boogie Nights. She might have been. She's
okay.
She's gosh, Nina. I don't want to say her age, but she's been around for quite a while. I think since the '70s. And she's an amazing woman. You would love her. She's a nurse and she does a lot of research
wow.
on. You should speak with her. Maybe I'll.
Well, what is your name?
Nina Hartley.
Okay. Well, I guess I'll have a playlist track with all adult film stars.
She's wonderful. She's done tons of research, and I think it would be a wonderful
okay.
conversation with the two
That'd
of you. But she, but you know, for me, I've always loved science. Part of what I love about my job now is it gives me a lot of free time to do research and to keep other activities active. My long-term goal, and I tell everybody this, part of the reason I do porn is I have a love for astronomy.
Mm.
So I hope to buy myself a little observatory far, far away
wow.
and have a little nonprofit observatory because I have a real love for that. And living in the city right now, I can't see the stars
right.
at night. So.
And especially, you're in LA area?
I'm in Los Angeles area,
so
yeah.
So the smog index is not a very good one.
Smog and the light pollution. You can't see
yeah,
anything
right.
but the moon.
Wow,
so,
wow.
yeah.
So that would be, okay, very nice. Well, listen, this has been fantastic. I can't wait to put it up and see what people think of it. I'm sure they'll really enjoy it. Thank you so much for doing this and hope to chat with you again soon.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you
anytime.
So much. I'm going to stop this now, but stay on the line. Oh, is there anything? I'm going to put your Twitter handle,
uh-huh.
And I'm also going to put your YouTube channel link. Is there anything else that you'd like me to put?
No, I think that's great.
That's good?
I think
okay.
that covers it. Yeah.
All right, so I'm going to stop the recording okay. and then stay on the line. All right.
Okay.